Jewish War, Book 5. Titus, having crossed the desert above Egypt as far as Syria in the manner already described, arrived at Caesarea, having decided to organize his forces there first. But while he was still in Alexandria helping his father settle into the command newly entrusted to them by God, it happened that the sedition in Jerusalem, which had already flared up, split into three factions, and one of these turned against the others. A development one might call, amid the general evil, a kind of good, and the work of justice. The assault of the zealots on the populace, which set in motion the city's capture, has already been described in full detail, its origin and the extent of the harm it grew to. But one would not be wrong to say that this new outbreak was sedition arising within sedition, and that, like a rabid beast which, for want of prey from outside, turns on its own flesh, so it was with Eleazar son of Simon. He was the very man who had first led the zealots to break away from the populace into the temple precinct, professing outrage at John's daily acts of daring, for John never rested from killing, but in truth unwilling to submit to a tyrant who had risen after him. Driven by desire for total control and by ambition for power of his own, he broke away, taking with him Judas son of Chelcias and Simon son of Ezron, men of standing, along with Hezekiah son of Chobar, no obscure figure. Not a few of the zealots followed each of them, and seizing the inner court of the temple above the sacred gates, they set up their weapons upon the holy porches. Being well supplied with provisions, they grew bold, for there was no shortage of sacred stores for those who counted nothing impious. But being few in number relative to their situation, they grew fearful, and keeping to their position, stayed put for the most part. John, for all his advantage in numbers of men, was correspondingly disadvantaged in position, and with the enemy holding the high ground over him, he neither made his attacks without fear nor kept still out of anger. Suffering more harm than he inflicted on Eleazar's men, he nonetheless would not let up. Constant sallies and volleys of missiles went on, and the temple was everywhere defiled with slaughter. Simon, son of Gioras, whom the people, in their desperate straits, had brought in as an invited tyrant of their own, in hope of relief, now held the upper city and much of the lower, and pressed his attacks on John's men all the more vigorously, since they too were under attack from above. He was, in effect, closing in on them from below just as those above were closing in on them. And so, with John fighting on two fronts, it came about that he both suffered harm and inflicted it with equal ease. To the extent that he was worsted by being lower than Eleazar's party, to that same extent, he had the advantage of height over Simon's. He therefore used his hand weapons to fend off the attacks from below with force, while checking those hurling javelins down from the temple above by means of his engines, for he had no small number of quick-firing catapults, stone throwers, and the like. With these, he not only warded off his attackers, but also killed many who were performing the sacred rites. For though they had abandoned themselves to every kind of impiety, they still let in those who wished to sacrifice, watching the locals with suspicion and searching visitors closely. Yet those who, despite passing this scrutiny at the entrances and shaming their captors' cruelty, made it inside became mere fuel consumed by the sedition. For missiles from the engines, carried by their force all the way to the altar and the sanctuary, fell upon the priests and those performing the rites, and many who had hastened from the ends of the earth to that place, sacred and revered by all people, in a single name known to both, fell before their own offerings, and drenched with their own blood that altar honored by both Greeks and barbarians alike. Corpses of natives and foreigners, of priests and the profane, were heaped together, and the blood of every sort of body pooled within the sacred courts. What suffering so great, O most wretched city, have you endured at the hands of the Romans, who came in only to purge with fire the pollutions your own people had brought upon you? For you were no longer God's dwelling place, nor could you remain so, having become a tomb for the bodies of your own people, and having turned the temple into a burial ground of civil war. Yet you might still become better again, if only you will one day appease the God who laid you waste. But I must restrain even my own feelings, in keeping with the law of the narrative, since this is not the moment for private lamentation, but for a recounting of events. I will now go through what followed in the course of the sedition. With the city's would-be masters divided three ways, Eleazar's men, who guarded the sacred first fruits, vented their drunken fury against John, Those with John plundered the citizens and rose up against Simon. And Simon, in turn, found the city itself his sustenance against his rivals. Whenever John was attacked from both sides at once, he would turn his men about, striking those advancing from the city from the direction of the porticos, while warding off with his engines those hurling javelins from the temple. But whenever he found himself free of the pressure from above, often, since drink and exhaustion gave his enemies pause, he would sally out with greater numbers and less fear against Simon's men. And wherever he drove them back within the city, he would set fire to the houses, full of grain and every kind of provision. And Simon, in turn, did the very same thing when John withdrew and he advanced, as if the two of them were deliberately helping the Romans by destroying what the city had prepared for the siege and cutting the very sinews of their own strength. As a result, everything around the temple was consumed by fire, and the city became a wasteland lying between two camps of its own people. Nearly all the grain, which would have sufficed them for many years of siege, was burned up. It was famine, then, that took the city, something that need never have happened had they not brought it upon themselves. With the city under attack on every side by these plotters and their rabble, the populace in between was torn apart like some great body. The old and the women, in their helplessness before the evils within, prayed for the Romans and longed for the war from outside as a release from the miseries within. Terrible dread and fear gripped the honest citizens. There was no chance to deliberate a change of course, no hope of a settlement, and no escape for those who wished it. For everything was under guard, and the ringleaders of the brigands, still quarreling over everything else, agreed on one thing only: killing those who deserved to live, treating them as common enemies whether they favored peace with Rome or were merely suspected of wanting to desert. The shouting of the combatants never ceased, by day or by night, but more terrible still were the wails of the mourners, cried out in dread. Their sorrows gave them endless fresh occasions for lament, yet their own terror stifled the cries. Muzzled by fear, they were tormented by groans stifled deep within. No one showed any regard any longer for the living among their own kin, nor any concern for the burial of the dead, both stemming from each person's private despair. For those who took no part in the fighting had given up all effort in everything, since they expected to perish at any moment regardless. Trampling over the corpses heaped one upon another, the fighters grappled with each other, growing wilder by drawing their frenzy from the bodies underfoot. Constantly devising some new means of ruin against their own people, and doing without restraint whatever was decided, they left untried no path of outrage or cruelty. Indeed, John even put the sacred timber to use in constructing engines of war. For the people and the chief priests had once resolved to shore up the temple and raise it 20 cubits higher, and King Agrippa, at enormous cost and effort, had brought down from Lebanon timber suited to the purpose, beams remarkable both for their straightness and their size. But the war intervened and cut short the project, and John cut up the timber and built towers of a height sufficient for fighting those above him in the temple. He set these towers up, brought forward behind the enclosure directly opposite the western portico, the one place where such an approach was possible, since all the other sections were separated by steps set some distance back. And so, he hoped to master his enemies with engines built from an act of impiety. But God showed his labor to be useless, bringing the Romans against him before he could set a single tower in place. For Titus, once he had gathered part of his forces to himself and ordered the rest to meet him before Jerusalem, marched out from Caesarea. There were three legions that had previously ravaged Judea together with his father, and in addition, the 12th, which had once suffered defeat under Cestius, a legion otherwise distinguished for its valor, and which now, mindful of what it had once suffered, advanced to take revenge with all the greater eagerness. Of these, he ordered the 5th to meet him by way of Emmaus, and the 10th to come up by way of Jericho, while he himself set out with the rest, joined also by far larger contingents of allied kings and numerous auxiliaries from Syria. The full strength of the four legions was likewise restored with troops that Vespasian had selected and sent along with Titus, out of those Mucianus had brought with him to Italy, for 2,000 picked men from the forces at Alexandria and 3,000 from the guards along the Euphrates accompanied him. Among his friends, the most esteemed for loyalty and judgment was Tiberius Alexander, who had previously governed Egypt for them and now commanded the forces. Judged worthy of this, by the welcome he had given to their newly rising power, of being among the first to attach himself, with conspicuous good faith, to a fortune still uncertain. And now, given his seniority and his experience, he served Titus as an advisor in the needs of the war. As Titus advanced into enemy territory, the allied kings and all the auxiliary forces went ahead, followed by road builders and camp surveyors. Then came the officers' baggage train, and behind their armed escorts, Titus himself, with his other picked troops and the lance bearers. Behind his unit came the cavalry. These rode ahead of the siege engines, and after them the tribunes and cohort commanders with their picked men. Then, around the eagle, came the standards, with the trumpeters preceding the standards, and after them the main body of infantry, spread six abreast. The servants of each legion came behind, and ahead of them the baggage train, while last of all came the hired troops, with their own guards bringing up the rear. Leading his forces forward in good order, as is customary for the Romans, he marched through Samaria into Gophna, a town previously seized by his father and now under garrison. There, after camping one evening, he set out again toward dawn, and after a day's march made camp at the place the Jews traditionally call the Valley of Thorns, near a village called Gabbath Saul, meaning the Hill of Saul, about 30 stadia from Jerusalem. From there he took with him about 600 picked cavalry and rode ahead to reconnoiter the city, to gauge its defenses and the temper of the Jews, whether the sight of him, before matters came to blows, would make them lose heart and yield. For he had learned, and it was indeed true, that the populace, cowed by the rebels and the brigands, longed for peace, but being too weak, could not rise up against the insurrection. So long as he rode straight up the highway leading to the wall, no one showed himself at the gates. But when he turned off the road toward the Cephinus Tower, veering his troop of cavalry off to the side, countless numbers suddenly sprang out near the towers called the Women's Towers, bursting out through the gate opposite the tombs of Helena, and cut off the cavalry there. Those still running along the road they blocked by standing to face them, preventing them from joining those who had turned aside, and they cut Titus himself off with only a few companions. He could not advance, for the ground around the gardens had been dug into trenches from the wall, and was broken up everywhere by cross walls and many enclosures. And he saw that to retreat to his own men was impossible, given the mass of enemies in between, and that most of those who had fled along the highway did not even realize the king was in danger, but supposing that he had turned back with them, fled on themselves. Seeing that his safety now rested solely on his own courage, he wheeled his horse about, called out to those with him to follow, and plunged into the midst of the enemy, forcing his way through to break out to his own men. It was here, above all, that one could grasp how the turns of war and the perils of kings are matters of concern to God. For though so many missiles were hurled at Titus, who wore neither helmet nor breastplate, having ridden out, as I said, not as a combatant but as a scout, not one touched his body, but all flew wide, as if by design missing their mark entirely. Slashing with his sword at those beside him, constantly cutting them down and overturning many who faced him, he drove his horse over the fallen. His enemies raised a shout at Caesar's daring and urged one another on to charge him, yet wherever he rode against them there was flight and a scattering of the crowd. Those sharing his danger kept close together, struck at from behind and from the side, for each man's one hope of survival was to keep pace with Titus and not fall behind to be surrounded. Two of those farther back were in fact surrounded, one cut down along with his horse by javelins, and the other, leaping down, killed his horse and was carried off on foot, but with the rest, Titus made it safely back to camp. This unexpected success in their first encounter roused the spirits of the Jews, and the momentary advantage gave them great confidence for what lay ahead. When that night the legion from Emmaus joined him, Caesar set out from there the next day and advanced to the place called Scopus, from which the city already came into view, along with the gleaming mass of the temple, for the place, lying low where it joins the northern side of the city, is aptly named Scopus, the lookout. 7 stadia from the city, he ordered a camp to be fortified for the two legions together, and 3 stadia behind them, another for the fifth, for he judged that this legion, worn out by its night march, deserved the safety of a more sheltered position while the others built their defenses. Just as the work of fortification was beginning, the 10th Legion also arrived, by way of Jericho, where a detachment of infantry had been stationed to guard the crossing previously secured by Vespasian. It had been ordered to make camp 6 stadia from Jerusalem, on the mountain called the Mount of Olives, which faces the city to the east, separated from it by a deep ravine called the Kidron. And when those in the city, who had been fighting each other without pause, suddenly found the strife within halted for the first time by the war from outside bursting in on them all at once. The rebels, in astonishment, when they saw the Romans encamped in 3 places, the rebels fell into evil agreement among themselves and asked one another what they meant to endure, sitting shut up behind 3 walls that blocked their very breath, while the war built its own city against them at its ease. And they themselves sat like spectators of fine and fortunate deeds, penned inside the walls, hands and armor set aside. "So we are brave only against each other," they cried, "while the Romans will win the city bloodlessly out of our own quarrel." With these words they rallied one another, and snatching up their arms, they suddenly ran out against the 10th Legion, and dashing through the ravine with a tremendous shout, fell upon the enemy while they were still fortifying their camp. The soldiers were scattered about the work, and for that reason had set aside most of their weapons, for they had not supposed the Jews would venture a sortie, and were thrown into unexpected confusion just as they were eager to be diverted from their fatigue by the very fighting. Some abandoned the work at once and withdrew, while many ran for their weapons and were struck down before they could turn to face the enemy. The Jews kept gaining more men, emboldened by the success of the first attackers, and, favored by fortune, believed themselves and appeared to their enemies far more numerous than they were. It is above all men accustomed to order, who know how to fight by discipline and command, whom sudden disorder catches off guard and throws into confusion. So it was that the Romans, caught unprepared by the assault, gave ground. Whenever those under attack turned to face them, they checked the Jews' charge, and since the Jews were less on their guard because of their own impetus, wounded them. But as the sortie kept swelling in numbers, the Romans, growing ever more disordered, were at last driven back from the camp. It seemed then that the whole legion would have been in danger, had not Titus, informed of what was happening, come speedily to its aid. Denouncing them bitterly for cowardice, he turned the fleeing men back, and himself, falling upon the Jews' flank with the picked men he had brought, killed many, wounded still more, and put all of them to flight, driving them down into the ravine. Battered badly on the descent, once they had made their way through it, they turned about again, and with the ravine between them, fought it out with the Romans. So they fought until midday. But as the day began to decline a little past noon, Titus, having set the reinforcements who had come with him and the men from the cohorts in array against those still sallying out, sent the rest of the legion back up to the fortification work on the ridge. To the Jews, this looked like flight, and when the man posted as lookout on the wall shook out his cloak, an even fresher crowd sprang forward with such fury that their charge might be likened to the wildest of beasts. None of those drawn up against them held their ground at the encounter. Struck as if by a machine, they broke their line and fled toward the mountain. Titus was left in the middle of the slope with only a few men, and though many of his friends, those who out of respect for their commander had stood their ground, scorning the danger, urged him earnestly to give way before Jews bent on death, and not to risk himself ahead of men whose duty it was to stand in front of him, to take thought for his own fortune and not fill the place of a common soldier when he was master of the war and of the world. And not to face so sharp a crisis at a moment when everything hung in the balance, to none of this would he even listen. He stood against those rushing at him, and striking them face to face killed those who pressed him, and falling upon the massed ranks on the slope drove the crowd back. They, terrified by his bearing and his strength, still did not flee straight into the city, but swerving aside from him pressed instead upon those fleeing further up the hill. These two he attacked on the flank, cutting off their impetus. Meanwhile, the men above, fortifying the camp, on seeing those below in flight, were seized again by panic and fear, and the whole legion scattered, believing that the Jews' onset was irresistible and that Titus himself had been routed. For surely, they thought, The rest would never flee while he still stood his ground. And as though gripped by a panic terror, they were carried off this way and that, until some, catching sight of their commander wheeling about in the midst of the fighting, and fearing greatly for him, shouted the danger to the whole legion. Shame then turned them back, and reproaching one another still more for flight, for having abandoned Caesar, they threw themselves with all their strength against the Jews, and once they had inclined down the slope, they drove them together into the hollow. The Jews, giving ground step by step, kept fighting, but the Romans, having the advantage of higher ground, forced them all together into the ravine. Titus pressed hard upon those before him, and sent the legion back once more to its wall building, while he himself, with those who had earlier stood by him, held off the enemy, so that, if the truth must be told without adding anything out of flattery or subtracting anything out of malice, Caesar in person twice rescued the whole legion when it was in danger, and secured for it the freedom to build its camp. When the fighting outside had abated for a little while, the sedition within flared up again. On the 14th day of the month Xanthicus, when the feast of unleavened bread was beginning, the day on which the Jews believed they were first delivered from the Egyptians, Eleazar's men opened the gates a crack and let in from the people those who wished to worship. But John, using the festival as a screen for his plot, armed the more obscure of his followers, most of whom were ritually unclean, secretly under their clothes, and sent them hurrying in to seize the temple beforehand. Once inside, they threw off their garments and suddenly stood revealed as armed men. At once the greatest confusion and uproar arose around the sanctuary, the people outside the sedition supposing the assault to be aimed indiscriminately at everyone, the zealots supposing it aimed at themselves alone. Some abandoned their posts guarding the gates and, leaping down from the battlements before coming to blows, fled into the underground passages of the temple. Others of the people, cowering by the altar and crowding around the sanctuary, were trampled underfoot, struck without restraint by clubs and by the sword. Many peaceable men were killed by their personal enemies and rivals out of private hatred and enmity, as though they were opponents of the sedition, and every man who had ever offended one of the conspirators was now recognized as a zealot and dragged off to be abused. Having inflicted many terrible things on the innocent, they granted a truce to the guilty, and let those who had come forward out of the underground passages go free. They themselves now held the inner sanctuary and all the stores of weapons within it, and grew bold against Simon. So the sedition, which before had been divided in three, now settled into two factions. Titus, wishing to move his camp nearer the city from Scopus, stationed against those making sorties a chosen force of horse and foot sufficient, he judged, for the purpose, and ordered the whole remaining force to level the ground as far as the wall. When every fence and enclosure that the inhabitants had set up for gardens and trees had been thrown down, and all the cultivated timber in between cut away, the hollows and ravines of the place were filled in, and the rocky outcrops were leveled with iron tools, until the whole area from Scopus to the tombs of Herod, which adjoined the pool called the Pool of the Serpents, was made level ground. In those same days, the Jews contrived the following ambush against the Romans. The bolder of the rebels went out beyond the towers called the Women's Towers, pretending to have been driven out by those who favored peace, and, feigning fear of the Romans' approach, kept huddling together and crouching before one another. Meanwhile, standing apart on the wall, a crowd that passed for the ordinary people cried out for peace and begged for a pledge of good faith, calling on the Romans and promising to open the gates. And even as they shouted this, they pelted their own comrades with stones, as though driving them away from the gates. Those men in turn pretended to be forcing their way toward the entrances and begging the people within, and repeatedly, as they rushed toward the Romans, they turned back again, giving the appearance of men in disorder. Among the soldiers, their trickery lost nothing of its credibility. Rather, holding those they thought they had in hand ready for punishment, and hoping the others would open the city, they set about the business. But Titus was suspicious of the strangeness of this appeal, for indeed, only the day before, when he had invited them through Josephus to come to terms, he had found no reasonable response from them. And so, on this occasion, he ordered the soldiers to stay in place. Some of those stationed at the earthworks, however, anticipated the order, snatched up their weapons, and ran out toward the gates. At first, those who seemed to have been driven out withdrew before them. But once the soldiers had come between the towers flanking the gate, the Jews ran out, encircled them, and pressed upon them from behind. And the men on the wall poured down a dense hail of stones and every kind of missile, killing a good many and wounding still more. For it was not easy to escape the wall while those behind kept forcing them on, and besides, shame at their blunder and fear of their officers drove them to persist in their mistake. So, thrusting with their spears for a long while and taking many blows from the Jews, though certainly giving back no fewer, they at last drove back those who had encircled them. And the Jews, retreating before them, followed them, still hurling missiles as far as the tombs of Helena. Then, exulting in their success with tasteless insolence, they jeered at the Romans for having been taken in by the trick, brandished their shields, leaped about, and shouted for joy. The soldiers, for their part, were met with threats from their officers and the anger of Caesar, who told them that the Jews, who were driven by nothing but desperation, did everything with forethought and calculation, laying ambushes and setting traps, and that even fortune attended their stratagems because of their obedience and their mutual trust and loyalty to one another. Whereas the Romans, whose fortune had always depended on their discipline and their obedience to their commanders, were now stumbling before their enemies and being caught through sheer lack of self-control in close combat. The most shameful thing of all, fighting without orders while Caesar himself was present. He said that the laws of military service would groan mightily over this, and his own father, when he learned of this blow, would groan mightily too, seeing that he himself, grown old in wars, had never suffered such a reverse, while the laws always punished with death even those who had disturbed their ranks in the slightest way. Yet now they had seen an entire army behave like deserters. They would soon learn, he said, those who had taken such license, that even victory among the Romans is held in disgrace when won without orders. Having spoken thus sharply to the officers, he made it plain he meant to apply the law against all of them. The men gave themselves up for lost, as though they were about to die justly at any moment. But the legions, gathering around Titus, pleaded for their fellow soldiers and begged him to grant to the obedience of all a pardon for the rashness of a few, promising that their future courage would make up for the present lapse. Caesar yielded, moved both by their entreaties and by considerations of advantage. For he judged that punishment against a single man should be carried through to the deed, but punishment against a multitude should stop at words. So he was reconciled with the soldiers, after admonishing them at length to be wiser in future, while he himself considered how to guard against the Jews' stratagems. In 4 days, the ground as far as the walls having been leveled, and wishing to bring up the baggage and the rest of the multitude in safety, he drew out the strongest part of his force in a line facing the wall along the northern side, and toward the west, deepening the phalanx to 7 ranks, with the infantry drawn up in front and the cavalry behind, each in 3 files, and the archers stationed in the 7th, middle rank. With the sorties of the Jews thus barred by so dense a mass, the pack-animals of the 3 legions and the multitude passed by in safety. Titus himself encamped about 2 stadia from the wall, opposite the corner where it turned, facing the tower called Cephanus, toward which the circuit of the wall, running down from the north, bends back toward the west. The other division of the army fortified its camp near the tower called Hippicus, likewise 2 stadia from the city. The 10th legion, however, remained in its place on the Mount of Olives. The city, fortified by 3 walls except where it was encircled by impassable ravines, for there a single wall sufficed, was itself built upon 2 hills facing each other, divided by a central ravine, into which the houses on both sides descended in tiers. Of the 2 hills, the one holding the upper city was much higher and straighter in its length. Because of its strength, it was called the Citadel by King David, the father of Solomon, who built the first temple, while we call it the Upper Market. The other hill, called the Acra, and supporting the lower city, was shaped like a crescent on both sides. Facing it was a 3rd hill, lower by nature than the Acra and separated from it, originally, by another broad ravine. But in later times, in the days when the Hasmoneans reigned, they filled in the ravine, wishing to join the city to the temple, and also cut down the height of the Acra, making it lower, so that the temple might be visible above it from that side as well. the ravine called the Valley of the Cheesemakers, which, as we have said, separates the hill of the upper city from that of the lower, runs down as far as Siloam, for so we call that spring, whose water is sweet and abundant. On the outside, the city's two hills were surrounded by deep ravines, and because of the cliffs on both sides, there was no approach to the city from any direction. Of the three walls, the old one was hard to capture both because of the ravines and because of the hill on which it was built above them. And besides the natural advantage of the site, it had also been strongly constructed, David and Solomon, and the kings who reigned between and after them, having taken great pride in the work. Beginning on the north at the tower called Hippicus and extending to the Xystus, it then joined the council chamber and reached completion at the western portico of the temple. On the other side, toward the west, beginning from the same point, it ran through the place called Bethso, extended to the Essene Gate, then turned south above the spring of Siloam. From there bent again toward the east to the Pool of Solomon, and, running on to a place called Ophlas, joined the eastern portico of the temple. The third wall began at the gate they called Geneth, part of the first wall, and circling the northern quarter alone, rose as far as the Antonia. Its beginning was the Hippicus Tower, from which it stretched to the northern district as far as the Cephanus Tower, then came down opposite the monuments of Helena. She was the queen of Adiabene, daughter of King Izates, and, running on for a long way through royal caves, bent at a corner tower by the tomb called the Fuller's Tomb, and joining the old circuit, ended at the valley called the Kidron. This was the wall Agrippa built around the newly settled part of the city, which had until then lain completely exposed. For as the population overflowed, it crept out little by little beyond the existing walls. Building up the northern side of the temple next to the hill, they advanced no small distance and came to inhabit even a fourth hill, called Bezetha, which lies opposite the Antonia, but is cut off from it by a deep trench. For it had been trenched on purpose, so that the foundations of the Antonia, not adjoining the hill, would be less accessible and less exposed to being overtopped. Indeed, the depth of the trench added considerably to the height of its towers. The newly built quarter was called in the local tongue Bezetha, which, translated into Greek, would mean new city. Since the people living there needed protection, Agrippa, the father of the present king and his namesake, began the wall we have described. But fearing that Claudius Caesar might suspect from the scale of the construction some plot of revolution and insurrection, he stopped after laying only the foundations. And indeed the city could not have been taken at all if the wall had been carried through as it was begun. Its stones were 20 cubits long and 10 cubits wide, fitted together so that they could neither easily be undermined with iron tools nor shaken loose by engines. The wall itself was 10 cubits thick, and its height, one may suppose, would have been still greater had the ambition of its founder not been cut short. Even so, when it was later raised in haste by the Jews, it reached 20 cubits, with battlements 2 cubits high and breastworks 3 cubits high, so that the whole height came to 25 cubits. The towers rising above the wall were 20 cubits wide and 20 cubits high, square and solid throughout like the wall itself, and the fitting and beauty of the stones fell in nothing short of a temple's. Above the solid 20-cubit height of the towers were costly chambers, and above these upper rooms and cisterns to catch the rainwater, with broad spiral stairways leading up in each one. The third wall had 90 such towers, the spaces between them 200 cubits each. The middle wall had 14 towers, and the old wall was divided into 60. The whole circuit of the city measured 33 stadia. Wonderful as the entire third wall was, more wonderful still was the Cephanus Tower, standing at its northwest corner, where Titus later pitched his camp. For being 70 cubits high, it afforded a view of Arabia at sunrise, and of the sea as far as the farthest boundary of the Hebrews' territory, and it was octagonal. Opposite this stood the Hippicus, and beside it two others, all built by King Herod within the old wall, towers unmatched in the inhabited world for size, beauty, and strength. For besides his naturally grand spirit and his ambition for the city, the king indulged his private feelings and honored the memory of the three people dearest to him, a brother, a friend, and a wife, after whom he named the towers. The wife he had, as we have said, put to death out of love, the other two he had lost in war, having fought bravely. The hippicus, named after his friend, was square, 25 cubits in width and in length each way, and 30 cubits in height, solid throughout without any hollow. Above this solid mass, joined seamlessly to the stonework, was a cistern 20 cubits deep for catching rain. Above this, a two-storied building 25 cubits high, divided into rooms of various design, above which rose turrets 2 cubits high and breastworks 3 cubits high, so that the total height came to 80 cubits. The second tower, which he named Facile after his brother, had width and length equal, 40 cubits each, and its solid mass rose to a height of 40 cubits. Above this ran a portico 10 cubits high, shielded by parapets and battlements, and in the middle of the portico was built another tower, divided into costly rooms and even a bathhouse, so that nothing was lacking to make the tower seem a palace. Its summit was crowned all around with battlements and turrets. The text here is corrupt. Its total height was about 90 cubits, and its shape resembled the lighthouse at Pharos, which guides sailors into Alexandria, though its girth was far greater. At the time of the siege, it served as the stronghold of Simon. The third tower, the Mariam, for so the queen was called, was solid up to 20 cubits, and measured 20 cubits in width and the same in length, but had above it living quarters more costly and more elaborate than the others, since the king thought it fitting that the tower named after his wife should be adorned more richly than those named after men, just as the men, he supposed, were stronger than the woman. Its total height was 55 cubits. Great as these three towers were in themselves, they appeared far greater still because of their position. For the old wall on which they stood was itself built on a high hill, and above the hill, a still higher summit rose 30 cubits, on which the tower stood, gaining thereby a great deal more in elevation. The size of the stones, too, was astonishing. They were not made of ordinary rubble, nor of stones a man could carry, but were cut from white marble. Each block was 20 cubits long, 10 wide, and 5 thick, and they were fitted together so precisely that each tower seemed to be a single rock that had grown there naturally, and only afterward been shaped by craftsmen's hands into its form and angles. So completely did the joints of the masonry disappear from view. Adjoining these towers on the north, within the wall, was the king's palace, beyond all description, for it lacked no extravagance or refinement whatsoever. It was walled all around to a height of 30 cubits, at regular intervals, set with ornamented towers and very large banquet halls that could seat 100 guests, in which the variety of stone was beyond describing, for much rare stone had been gathered there from every quarter. The ceilings were marvelous for the length of their beams and the brilliance of their ornament, and the number and variety of the rooms surrounding them was countless, and every one of them was fully furnished, most of what lay in each made of silver and gold. There were many colonnades running one into another in a circuit, each with its own distinct columns, and the open ground before them was everywhere green, with varied plantings and long walkways running through them, and around these deep channels and cisterns everywhere full of bronze fountainwork, through which the water poured out, and around the streams many dovecotes of tame pigeons. But indeed it is not possible to describe the palace adequately, and the memory of it brings its own torment, recalling all that was consumed by the fire of the rebels. For it was not the Romans who burned these buildings, but, as we said before, the conspirators within at the start of the revolt. The fire began at the Antonia, then spread to the palace and consumed the roofs of the three towers. The temple, as I have said, stood on a strong hill, and at first the summit of the hill scarcely sufficed for the temple and the altar, for the ground all around was steep and precipitous. King Solomon, who built the temple, walled up the eastern side, and a single portico was set upon the fill. On the other sides, the temple stood exposed. In the ages that followed, as the people continually added fill, the hill was leveled and widened. They also broke through the northern wall and gained as much ground as the whole enclosure of the later temple would come to occupy. Walling the hill about from its base on three sides, and completing a work greater than had been hoped, for which long ages were spent, and all the sacred treasures too, which the tribute sent to God from every part of the world had filled, they built around both the upper enclosures and the lower temple. Its lowest part was walled up from a depth of 300 cubits, and in some places more. Not all the depth of the foundations was visible, for they filled in the ravines to a great extent, wanting to level the narrow streets of the city. The stones were 40 cubits in the building, for the abundance of money and the people's zeal made the undertakings greater than words can express, and what had seemed impossible to hope for was in the end accomplished through persistence and time. Worthy of such foundations, too, were the works raised above them. The porticos were all double, their columns 25 cubits high, monolithic of the whitest marble, roofed over with cedar paneling. Their natural richness, their smoothness, and their harmony offered a remarkable sight, though none of them was further adorned on the outside with painting or carving. The streets were 30 cubits wide, and the whole circuit of the porticos measured 6 stadia, including the Antonia. The open courtyard was entirely paved with variegated stone. Passing through this toward the second temple, one came to a stone balustrade, 3 cubits high, very gracefully worked. On it stood pillars at equal intervals proclaiming the law of purity, some in Greek letters, some in Latin, that no foreigner should pass within the sanctuary, for the second temple was called the Holy Place. 14 steps led up to it from the first court, and above it was square and enclosed by its own wall. Its outer height, though 40 cubits, was hidden by the steps. Its inner height was 25 cubits, since being built on a higher elevation, not all of it was visible from inside, being masked by the hill. After the 14 steps came a level space 10 cubits wide before the wall, entirely flat. From there other stairways of 5 steps led up to the gates, of which 8 faced north and south, 4 on each side, and 2 faced east, of necessity. For since a separate area for the women's worship had been partitioned off on that side, a second gate was required there, cut directly opposite the first. And from the other quarters, there was 1 gate to the south and 1 to the north, through which entrance was made into the women's court, for through the others women were not permitted to pass, nor even through their own gate could they cross the partition. This area was open equally to the native women and to those of their people coming from abroad for worship. The western side had no gate at all, the wall there being unbroken. The porticos between the gates, running from the wall inward before the treasury chambers, were carried on very fine and large columns. They were single, and except in size fell short in nothing of those below. Of the gates, 9 were covered all over with gold and silver, the doorposts and lintels alike, but 1, outside the sanctuary itself, was of Corinthian bronze, and far surpassed in value the gold and silver-plated ones. Each gateway had 2 doors, each door 30 cubits high and 15 cubits wide. Beyond the entrances, widening further inward, there were on each side chambers 30 cubits square, tower-like in width and length, rising above 40 cubits in height. Each was held up by 2 columns 12 cubits in circumference. All the other gates were of the same size, but the one above the Corinthian gate, opening from the women's court on the eastern side opposite the gate of the sanctuary, was far larger. For its rise was 50 cubits, its doors 40 cubits, and its ornamentation more lavish, with a thick overlay of silver and gold. It was Alexander, the father of Tiberius, who paid for the plating of the 9 gates. 15 steps led up to the greater gate from the women's partition, since the steps at the other gates were shorter by 5. The temple itself, standing in the middle, the holy sanctuary, was reached by 12 steps, and its front was equal in height and width, 100 cubits each way, though behind it was narrower by 40 cubits. For in front, like shoulders, it projected 20 cubits on each side. Its first gate was 70 cubits high and 25 cubits wide, and had no doors at all, displaying the unbounded, unenclosed expanse of the sky. Its facades were entirely gilded, and through it the first chamber was visible in its entirety from outside, being very large, and everything around the inner gate, gleaming with gold, struck the eyes of those who looked on it. The temple within being 2 stories, only the first chamber stood open before them, rising continuously to a height of 90 cubits, extending 50 cubits in length and 20 in width. A curtain of equal length hung before it, a Babylonian tapestry embroidered with blue, fine linen, scarlet, and purple, a marvel of workmanship whose blending of materials was not without meaning. It seemed to be an image of the universe. The scarlet appeared to signify fire, the linen the earth, the blue the air, and the purple the sea, the first 2 by their color, the linen and the purple by their origin, since the one is produced by the earth and the other by the sea. On this curtain, the whole vista of the heavens was worked, except for the signs of the zodiac. Passing inside, one came to the level part of the sanctuary. Its height was 60 cubits and its length the same, its breadth 20 cubits. This space of 60 cubits was again divided. The first section, cut off at 40 cubits, contained the three most admired and celebrated objects in the world, the lampstand, the table, and the altar of incense. The seven lamps represented the planets, for that is how many branches were divided off from the lampstand. The 12 loaves on the table represented the circle of the zodiac and the year. And the altar of incense, through its 13 spices gathered from the sea, from uninhabited land, and from inhabited land, signified that all things are of God and for God. The innermost part measured 20 cubits and was likewise separated from the outer section by a curtain. Nothing whatsoever stood inside it. It was inaccessible, undefiled, and unseen by anyone, and it was called the Holy of Holies. Along the sides of the lower sanctuary ran many chambers, three stories high, communicating with one another, with entrances into them from the gate on either side. The upper section had no such chambers, since it was narrower there. It rose to a height of 40 cubits and was plainer than the story below. Adding these 40 to the 60 of the ground level gives a total height of 100 cubits. Its outer face left nothing that could astonish either the mind or the eyes. Covered on every side with massive plates of gold, it flashed back at the first rays of the rising sun, a fire so intense that it forced those who tried to look at it to turn away, as though from the sun's own beams. To strangers approaching from a distance, it looked like a mountain covered in snow, for where it was not gilded, it was of the purest white. On its summit stood sharpened golden spikes, so that no bird could perch there and defile it. Some of the stones used in it were 45 cubits long, 5 in height, and 6 in breadth. In front of it stood the altar, 15 cubits high and 50 cubits square, with horn-shaped projections at its corners. A gently rising ramp led up to it from the south. It was built without the use of iron, and iron never touched it. A handsome balustrade of stone, about a cubit high, ran around both the sanctuary and the altar, separating the people on the outside from the priests. Those with a discharge and lepers were barred from the city altogether. Women in their monthly courses were barred from the temple, though even when clean they were not permitted to pass beyond the boundary just mentioned. Men who had not fully purified themselves were kept from the inner court, and among the priests too, those who were not in a state of purity were excluded. Those of priestly descent who, because of some bodily blemish, could not perform the services still had access, along with the unblemished, to the area within the balustrade, and received their share of the offerings by rite of birth, though they wore ordinary dress, since only the officiating priest put on the sacred garments. The unblemished priests, when they went up to the altar and the sanctuary itself, wore linen and abstained above all from wine, for fear of transgressing in some part of the service out of drunkenness. The high priest went up with them, though not always, only on Sabbaths, new moons, and any ancestral feast or general festival celebrated during the year. When he officiated, he covered his thighs down to his private parts with a waistcloth, put on a linen tunic beneath, and over it a robe reaching to the feet, of blue, round in shape and fringed. From the fringes hung golden bells alternating with pomegranates, the bells signifying thunder and the pomegranates lightning. The sash that fastened the robe at the chest was worked with a pattern of 5 bands in gold, purple, scarlet, linen, and blue, the same materials we noted that were woven together in the temple's curtains. Over these, he wore also a breastplate of mixed material, in which gold predominated, shaped like the breastplate of a cuirass. 2 golden clasps in the form of small shields fastened it, set with 2 large and beautiful sardonyx stones, on which were engraved the names of the tribes of the nation. On the other side were fixed 12 more stones, arranged 3 to a row in 4 rows, sardius, topaz, and emerald, carbuncle, jasper, and sapphire, agate, amethyst, and ligure, onyx, beryl, and chrysolite, and on each of these again was engraved the name of one of the tribes. His head was covered by a linen turban wound about with blue, and around this ran another crown of gold, bearing in relief the sacred letters. These are 4 vowels. He did not wear this full array all the time, but put on a plainer one except when he entered the inner sanctuary, which he did alone, once a year, on the day when it is the custom for all to fast before God. We shall speak again, in more detail, of the city, the temple, and the customs and laws connected with it, for no small account remains to be given of them. The Antonia stood at the corner of two porticos of the outer temple court, the western and the northern, and was built upon a rock 50 cubits high, sheer on every side. It was the work of King Herod, in which above all he displayed the greatness of his natural genius. First, from its base the rock was covered over with smooth slabs, both for beauty and so that anyone attempting to climb up or down would slip. Then, in front of the tower's structure, ran a wall 3 cubits high, and within this the whole mass of the Antonia rose to a height of 40 cubits. Inside, it had the space and arrangement of a palace, for it was divided into every kind of room and use, colonnades, baths, and broad courtyards for troops, so that by having everything necessary it seemed a city, and by its luxury a palace. Being tower-shaped in its overall form, it was set off at each corner by 4 further towers, 3 of them 50 cubits high, while the one at the southeast corner rose to 70 cubits, so that from it the whole temple could be seen. Where it joined the temple's porticos, it had stairways down on both sides by which the guards descended, for a Roman cohort was always stationed there, and at the festivals they took up positions around the porticos, under arms, to watch the people and prevent any uprising. For the temple was a fortress guarding the city, and the Antonia guarded the temple. In the Antonia was posted the guard for all three. The upper city, in turn, had its own fortress in Herod's palace. The hill called Bezetha was separated, as I said, from the Antonia, and being the highest of all the hills, it was joined to part of the new city. It alone overshadowed the temple from the north. On the city and its walls it will be enough, for the present, to have said this much, having promised to describe each in more detail later. The fighting and factious element in the city was, around Simon, 10,000 strong, apart from the Idumeans, with 50 officers commanding the 10,000, and Simon in supreme command of the whole. The Idumeans who joined him numbered about 5,000 and had 10 leaders of their own, of whom Jacob son of Sosas and Simon son of Cathla were reckoned the foremost. John, who had seized the temple, had 6,000 armed men under 20 officers, and joining him at that time too were the Zealots, who had ceased their internal quarrel, 2,400 of them, under their previous commander Eleazar and Simon son of Aranus. While these two factions warred with each other, as we have said, the populace was the prize fought over by each, and whatever part of the people took no share in their crimes was plundered by both. Simon held the upper city and the great wall as far as the Kidron, and of the old wall the part running from the pool of Siloam eastward down to the palace of Monobazus, the king of the Adiabenes beyond the Euphrates. He also held the spring and the Acra, that is, the lower city, as far as the palace of Helena, mother of Monobazus. John held the temple and the area around it for some distance, together with Ophlas and the ravine called the Kidron. The ground between these two holdings they had set ablaze in their war against each other and abandoned, for even with the Romans encamped against the walls, the internal strife did not rest. After a brief lull following their first sortie against the besiegers, the sickness broke out again, and once more they separated and fought among themselves, doing everything the besiegers could have wished. Indeed, they suffered nothing worse at the hands of the Romans than what they inflicted on one another, and after this, the city experienced no new kind of suffering. Rather, before its fall, it had already met with a harsher fate at its own hands, and those who captured it accomplished something greater still. For I say that it was the sedition that destroyed the city, and the Romans who destroyed the sedition, which was far stronger than its walls. What is grim in this belongs, in fairness to its own people, what is just, one might reasonably credit to the Romans. Let each reader judge as he is inclined. While matters inside stood thus, Titus, riding around outside with a picked body of cavalry, surveyed where he might best assault the walls. He was at a loss on every side, for the ravines made approach impossible in one direction, and on the other the first wall appeared too strong for his engines. So he decided to attack near the monument of John the High Priest. There the outer wall was lower, and the second did not join it, since the builders had neglected to fortify that stretch as the new city was not thickly settled there. From that point access was easy, by which he intended to take the upper city and, through the Antonia, the temple as well. While he was going about this reconnaissance, one of his friends, named Nicanor, was shot in the left shoulder. He had come close, along with Josephus, and was attempting to negotiate peace terms with the men on the wall, for he was not unknown to them. Learning through this incident their true disposition, Caesar, seeing that they would not spare even those who approached them offering safety, was provoked to press the siege, and at the same time ordered his legions to devastate the country before the city and gathered timber to raise the earthworks. He divided the army in three for the works, and stationed in the midst of the earthworks the javelin men and archers, and in front of these the quickfirers, catapults, and stone-throwing engines, so as to keep off enemy sorties against the work and to check those trying to hinder it from the wall. As the trees were cut down, the suburbs were quickly stripped bare, and while the timber was being brought together for the earthworks and the whole army was pressing on with the work, matters on the Jewish side were no less active. The populace, engaged in plunder and murder, took heart at this time, for they supposed they would get some respite once their masters were distracted by the enemy outside, and that they themselves would exact justice from the guilty parties if the Romans should prevail. John, though those around him were eager to move against the enemy outside, held back for fear of Simon. Simon, however, was not idle, for he was nearer to the siege works, and he set up on the wall the engines he had earlier taken from Cestius, and those captured along with the garrison of the Antonia. But most of his men found these of no use for lack of skill in handling them. Only a few, taught by deserters, put the engines to poor use, while with slings and bows they struck at the men building the earthworks, and sallying out in formations, closed with them. The workmen were sheltered from missiles by wicker screens stretched above the entrenchments, and from the sorties by the engines set against those who charged out. Engines of remarkable design fitted to all the legions, but especially formidable in the 10th, whose quickfirers were more powerful and whose stone throwers larger, able to overturn not only the sorties but the defenders on the wall as well. The stones hurled weighed a talent and traveled 2 furlongs or more, and their impact was irresistible not only to those first struck, but to those far behind them as well. At first the Jews kept watch for the stone, for it was white, so that it could be detected not only by its whir but seen by its brightness as well. Watchmen therefore sat on the towers and gave warning, whenever the engine was released and the stone came flying, calling out in their native tongue, "The sun is coming." And the men in its path would part and throw themselves down beforehand, so that by taking this precaution the stone often passed through harmlessly. In response, the Romans thought to blacken it, for then, no longer seen in time, it found its mark and destroyed many at a single throw. Yet even under this punishment, they did not let the Romans raise their earthworks unmolested, but used every device and daring, by night and by day, to hinder them. When the works were finished, the engineers measured with lead weight and cored the distance to the wall, throwing the line down from the earthworks, since there was no other way to measure it while under fire from above. Finding the siege towers able to reach, they brought them up. Titus, moving the artillery closer so that it would not keep the battering rams from the wall, ordered the assault to begin. As a tremendous crash resounded from 3 directions at once and suddenly filled the city, a cry went up from those within, and equal terror fell upon the rebels. Seeing that the danger now threatened them both alike, the two factions decided to make common cause in defending the city. As their leaders shouted to one another that everything they were doing served the enemy's interests, and that even if God did not grant them lasting harmony, at least for the present they ought to set aside their rivalry and unite against the Romans, Simon proclaimed an amnesty allowing the men from the temple to come over to the wall, and John, though distrustful, allowed it as well. Setting their hatred and their private quarrels behind them under this amnesty, they became a single body. Surrounding the wall, they hurled a massive fire down on the siege engines and kept up an unbroken barrage against the men working the battering rams, while the boldest of them dashed out in companies and tore at the wicker screens protecting the machines, falling on the crews inside them. Skill counted for little in this, but daring achieved a great deal. Titus himself constantly came to the aid of his hard-pressed men, stationing cavalry and archers on either side of the engines. He kept off those bringing up fire, drove back the men shooting from the towers, and kept the battering rams working. Even so, the wall would not yield to their blows, except that the ram of the 15th Legion managed to dislodge the corner of one tower. The wall itself remained intact, since it did not immediately share the tower's fate. The tower projected well beyond the line and could not easily bring down any part of the circuit wall with it. After a brief pause in their sorties, the Jews watched for a moment when the Romans, worn out, had scattered to their work and their camps to rest, since weariness and fear seemed to be driving them back. Then they dashed out by the Hippicus Tower through a hidden gate, all of them setting fire to the works and pressing on toward the Roman fortifications themselves. At the sound of their shouting, the nearest Romans rallied quickly, and those farther off came running. Jewish daring outran Roman discipline, and having routed the first men they met, they pressed on against those who were gathering to oppose them. A fierce battle broke out around the machines, one side struggling to set them ablaze, the other to stop them. The shouting on both sides was a formless roar, and many of those fighting in the front ranks fell. The Jews had the advantage in sheer recklessness, and the fire was already catching the works. Everything, engines included, would have been in danger of burning up had not the picked troops from Alexandria stood their ground, many of them proving braver than anyone expected, distinguishing themselves in this battle beyond even some of the more famous soldiers. At last, Caesar himself, taking the strongest of his cavalry, charged into the enemy. He cut down 12 of their front fighters with his own hand, and when the rest of the mass gave way at the sight of their fall, he pursued and drove them all back into the city, rescuing the works from the fire. It happened in this battle that one of the Jews was taken alive. Titus ordered him crucified before the wall, hoping the sight might frighten the rest into submission. After the retreat, John, the commander of the Idumeans, was killed as he stood before the wall talking with a soldier he knew. One of the Arab allies shot him through the chest with an arrow, and he died on the spot, leaving the Idumeans in deep mourning and the rebels in grief, for he had been outstanding both in combat and in judgment. The following night, an unexpected panic fell upon the Romans as well. Titus had ordered 3 towers, each 50 cubits high, built so that from their platforms, stationed on each of the earthworks, he could drive back the defenders on the wall. But one of these towers happened to collapse on its own in the middle of the night. The tremendous crash that rose from it struck fear into the army, and thinking the enemy was attacking them, they all rushed to arms. Confusion and uproar spread through the legions, and since no one could say what had happened, the men, in growing alarm, scattered in different directions. With no enemy in sight, they frightened one another, and in their haste, each man anxiously asked his neighbor for the watchword, as though the Jews had already broken into the camps. They were seized by a panic like men surrounded on every side, until Titus, learning what had happened, had the news passed to everyone, and only then did the disorder gradually die down. As for the Jews, though they held out stubbornly against everything else, the towers did them great harm. From their heights, the lighter engines, along with javelin men, archers, and slingers, kept up a barrage against them, and the defenders, because of the height, could not reach them in return. The towers themselves could not easily be pulled down, being too heavy, nor set on fire, being sheathed in iron. The defenders, forced back out of range, could no longer prevent the battering rams from striking home, and these, hammering away without pause, gradually made progress. Once the wall began giving way under the ram, the Jews themselves called Nico, because it conquered everything, the defenders, already worn out from long fighting and from keeping watch through the nights far from the city, and moreover judging, out of laziness and poor planning generally, that this wall no longer mattered since 2 more lay behind it, lost heart, and most of them withdrew. When the Romans mounted the breach Nico had made, abandoning their posts, all of them fled to the second wall. Those who had gone over the wall opened the gates and let the whole army in. So the Romans took the first wall on the 15th day of the siege, the 7th of the month Artemisius, and demolished a large part of it, along with the northern section of the city, which Cestius had also destroyed before them. Titus then moved his camp inside, to the place called the Assyrian camp, occupying the entire space up to the Kidron Valley, keeping just out of range of the second wall, and began his assault at once. The Jews divided their forces and defended the wall stubbornly. John's men fought from the Antonia Fortress, the northern portico of the temple, and the area in front of the tombs of King Alexander, while Simon's forces held the stretch by the tomb of John the High Priest, barricading it as far as the gate through which the water was brought in to the Hippicus Tower. They repeatedly dashed out from the gates to fight hand to hand, and though driven back from the wall in these clashes, being untrained compared to Roman skill, they held their own in the fighting along the wall itself. Roman experience combined with strength carried the day against them, while Jewish daring was fed by fear and by their natural endurance under hardship. There was still hope of survival on both sides, for the Romans, hope of a quick victory. Weariness touched neither side. Assaults, wall fighting, and company sorties went on continually through the whole day, and no form of combat was left untried. Night barely gave them rest before dawn resumed it. Sleepless for both sides, the nights were harder than the days, since each feared, the Romans, that the wall would fall at any moment, the Jews, that the Romans would fall upon their camps. Both sides spent the night under arms and were ready for battle at first light. Among the Jews, there was rivalry over who would risk himself first to win favor with the commanders. And above all, there was reverence and fear of Simon, so that each of his subordinates obeyed him so completely that, had he ordered it, a man would have been ready to take his own life. The Romans, for their part, were spurred to courage by habitual victory, unfamiliarity with defeat, constant campaigning, unbroken training, and the sheer scale of their empire, and above all by Titus, who was always present everywhere with everyone.